What's up, everybody? I am back in Seoul. I landed a couple days ago. I just got done recording two episodes of KSL and these crazy marathon broadcasts. I get in the studio at like 2 p.m. and I don't end up leaving until like 10:30. So I got back, did two recordings there. Now I'm in my apartment hanging out, having a do nothing day besides making this quick little intro and then the outro too. Got to play a little bit of StarCraft this morning. My takeaway with that was fuck Zerg. I cannot beat them right now. I also just got Death Stranding, which I'm planning on starting later on tonight. Looks really cool. I'm really excited for that. I hope. I was a big Metal Gear Solid guy growing up, so and that was like that's like the Game of Thrones for gamers at the time. That was such a good storyline. So I'm very curious to see what this Hideo Kojima game is going to be like. I got really high expectations. Anyways. This episode of the podcast is with my buddy Pig. He's a WCS caster. He's also, how do I say this? He's someone who educates people on how to get better at StarCraft II Online. He streams a lot. Definitely check his stream out. But he's an all-around really smart dude, so I really was excited to sit down and chat him up. We talked about a lot of cool stuff and what it's like to be an Australian pro gamer where you are on a moon base, basically. You are so far away from everything and what that's like traveling to tournaments and what the transition was like becoming a caster. I think you guys are going to really like this episode. I will also be dropping another episode in a couple days, just my thoughts on BlizzCon. I don't quite have time to do this today, but in a couple days, I'll be doing a recap on how it was and you know the announcements and everything else going on with Blizzard. So that'll be coming out soon. Before we start, as usual, if you can support the podcast, please do go to patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. We do have private episodes that are recorded that are only for Patreon donors, and we're still working out more ways to give you guys more awesome stuff if you support us. The money that you guys donate there is going to buy a bigger and better equipment so we can make this show more awesome. We are going to be doing video episodes soon. We unlocked that Patreon a while ago. But we haven't bought the cameras yet, and I didn't want to go to BlizzCon and try to film this for my first time without any help. So we have a few more podcasts in the pipeline, and then we're going to start doing video episodes, which I'm very excited to be doing, and we're going to be setting up some more Patreon goals there as well. So if you like this, and you can support it if you've got the money, it's really appreciated. And that'll do it for the Patreon plug. Now let's go to the episode with my buddy Pig. So, man, how many times have you been in LA now?
Ooh.
Or for BlizzCon, I guess I should start there.
I came for 2015. I came as a fan, so that was my first one. Yeah.
And then you've been here ever since, right? Every year since then?
Yeah, yeah. So then 2016 was the first one I worked, and I didn't do opening week. So I got flown in, and I got to do one best of five, and it was 3-0. And I was like, wait, I'm done? And they're like, oh, no, you can do some couch segments. And I'm like, well, it's like, I don't know. That's like just Philly, you know? It's not even
right,
work,
right, right?
Right? Yeah, so it was,
yeah.
That was pretty funny.
And then have you been to the States before this, or have you almost exclusively visited LA or I guess Anaheim in this case?
Yeah, I mean, I got to go to Austin last year, and that was actually the first time doing StarCraft other than LA. Because, like, actually, I don't think I've been to America otherwise. When I was a little kid, I came to, like, Disney World, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I vaguely remember coming for Disney World and going to, like, some family friend's farm out in Florida or something like that, but that's about it. So then I've literally come through America going to like Canada and had the experience of, you know, I'm like, wait, I'm going to Canada. And like, oh, you've got to come into America though. So you've got to like go through immigration and that whole process.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, LA, it's one of these things where it's not the coolest city, right? Like I've been to Austin last year. And I was like, oh, this is a city I could live in.
Yeah.
It's really fun to hang around.
People from LA will kind of act like it's the coolest city, but I and also, you know, Anaheim itself is kind of an odd, almost alien place in of itself. Because we're next to Disneyland, for people listening. The convention center where BlizzCon's held is basically adjacent to Disneyland, and everything around here is Disney themed.
Yeah, there's the hotel down the road. It's got like the colored windows. It's like a Disney princess castle.
Yeah.
It's like the hotel is like a little castle and stuff. It's actually really funny, man.
Yeah, it's really trippy being down here.
Well, it's just restaurants and stuff. Like there's no one lives
here.
It's just car park upon car park, restaurants, and then you've got Disneyland, which is a suburb in of itself, right?
I've always wondered what the Koreans think of this when they come here because
They're like, is this America?
This is America. There's hotels and giant open streets. And I guess also the thing for me that kind of surprises me when I come back here, because I've been in Korea for so long that I don't know if I always qualify as an American for like worldviews or...
Yeah.
Obviously, my day-to-day life is different, but the extraordinary number of really obese people, especially at Disneyland.
Yeah.
That is just...
Well...
I mean, we're talking like knee fat big people. Like I mean, they just don't have that in Asia and in other
like
parts of the world.
Where the thigh goes beyond the knee, right? Like the top half of the leg is somehow hanging below the bottom half of the leg.
And maybe what I'm saying sounds like fucked up or mean, but you just don't have people that big out in other parts of the world. And I was used to it when I grew up in Kansas City, which I think is actually among the fatter cities in the United States. So you kind of, I guess, get desensitized to it.
Well,
when you're there, but then I was in Korea where everybody's skinny and pretty glamorous.
The opposite, right? Yeah. Like whenever I go around Korea, I always think Korea and Sweden are the two places where I always feel like I'm really unfashionable and unfit and like not well groomed, because everyone in like Seoul is so well groomed.
Yeah.
Everybody like has their hairstyle. They're all wearing really like crisp suits and stuff. But everyone's also really, really skinny, and they will like just point at you if you're fat there. They'll be like, oh, look, that guy's fat. Like,
yeah.
like if you're obese there, they'll just be like, oh, like, and it's the same, you know, Asian culture, right? I remember, because I grew up, obviously, you know, in a very white family, but from high school onwards, heaps of Asian friends. And you get exposed more and more to people's, like, parents just being like, oh, you're fat. Like, you need to lose weight and stuff, right?
Yeah.
They've got this very upfront thing. They're like, oh, you have really bad acne. You need to go to the doctor and get it sorted. And that's something growing up, like none of my white friends would ever act that way. But then I've become more, I think, like brutal and honest with my friends about that stuff, because I've been around enough Asian culture now where I'm just like, oh, you're like getting fat, man. Like,
no,
you know,
same thing for me. I guess it's a major cultural difference in that, at least in a lot of Western culture, but I'd even say more like a lot more Caucasian, and in this case, American culture from my experience, we don't talk about each other's appearances.
Yeah, it's a taboo
topic. I think positive or negative. It's just sort of a thing that you don't bring up, where in a lot of Asian cultures, at least the ones I've experienced, because Asian can be kind of an ambiguous term for a lot of different places.
Well,
it's obviously
a pretty broad category.
Yeah.
Like, we are talking in generalizations, but yeah.
We're casting a wide net with that. But for instance, Korean culture, they will just remark on your appearances, good or bad.
Yeah.
So I've gotten the best compliments in my life from Koreans, and also the biggest, most crushing, ego-blowing things I've ever heard in Korea as well.
They'll come up and they'll like they'll just like pat your belly, you know. Like I really like watching the Korean players with Won with the special, because they're just come up and just like, oh, I got to rub his belly for good luck or something. Like they're so funny about it. I'm like, oh, because they're also the personal space thing, right? Like a lot of Koreans are very touchy feely as well.
Yeah.
They'll kind of come up and just like, if they're comfortable with you, they'll put their hand around you. They'll like touch your arm, like stroke your shoulder or something. And that as well, and you combine that with not caring about like someone being fat or something. They'll just like stroke the belly, you know, they'll like poke the love handle, and you'll be like, oh, okay. This is a bit different to what I'm used to. This is not in my comfort zone, but like I guess it's actually cool that you're just, you know, comfortable with that.
Yeah, I think I'm more touchy-feely after living in Korea for a while. I guess I was a little bit more of a touchy-feely guy.
You have a few soju shots with Dan, you know,
I get a little cuddly. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of crazy how totally different, you know, these cultures are and how you behave in closeness and stuff. And I feel like the more I travel, the more I kind of soak in all the different parts of that. Since we're in kind of a weird part of America, right? We're right by Disneyland, which, at least from my perspective, that's kind of where a lot of middle-income Americans, especially from the middle of the country, come in for their big vacation because it's affordable. And you know, it's kind of the pinnacle of American culture in a lot of ways is the Disney movies, Star Wars, for their entertainment. But it is very weird because there's, you know, a lot of people riding around on these, scooters, I guess you'd say, obese people.
Yeah. The mobility scooters.
Right. Yeah. You hear a lot of, accents that you wouldn't hear if you're on the coasts. Is there any Australian version of this?
Yeah.
Like, is there a place in Australia that is,
I guess,
or outside?
Yeah, I probably think of, like, the Gold Coast. Like, you know, it's just somewhere is, like, such a popular holiday destination that you get people from all around the country. But especially, I mean, that's, like you said, it's where you get people from the middle parts of the country, the small towns and stuff, where it becomes really special for them to go out to Disney. For us, like, the Gold Coast is just, like, this beach city that's just, you know, super touristy. It's just beaches, and then you've got, like, all the weird entertainment stuff that pops up around it. Like, around here, right? Last night, we went out and had dinner, and we went through this arcade, and there's, like, magic shops and, like, oh, fortune tellers and all this, you know, just, like, weird kind of tacky
entertainment
stuff.
It's
kind of
like hokey
stuff.
80s
yeah.
Los Angeles. It's almost like an export from Las Vegas, but kind of
yeah.
old school it's magician like- stuff before we kind of concluded that magic tricks were more embarrassing.
Yeah, and it's like a 90s cinema or something. They're like, yeah. you know, they like spray some water on you or something. It's like all this stuff kind of springs up around these areas if it's enough of a touristy space. And then like, maybe an hour or two out of there, there is like a whole bunch of all of Australia's theme parks. So it's kind of got that Disney feel to it a little bit, but here it's like Disneyland is such a special, original kind of place, right? So
yeah.
this entire neighborhood is like all around this one theme park, and it's, I mean, I've only been once, but it was so well put together as well. So like, I totally get the whole kind of idea behind it and why everyone goes, personally, I don't think I'd ever go a second time just because theme parks aren't really my thing. But it is interesting when
yeah,
you just
I don't like lines. Lines,
yeah.
Really, I can't handle it.
Yeah. I think lining up all day for stuff, I don't know. I like some of the rides. But yeah, I would want to go on like peak off season. Whatever like the time is when no one's there and I have a theme park to myself. But even then, you know, you've got to be into like the princesses and the things and all this sort of stuff. Like, you know, there's like a fun Star Wars ride, but overall, it's probably not my deal.
Yeah, I think that's the first time I went to Australia. Actually, I've only been once, exactly once, I should say. But the time I went to Australia, I was in Sydney.
Yep.
Got to cast some of your games, I believe.
Yeah.
You were a player back then.
Yeah, yeah. I won the Australian tournament that
you
came
beat,
to. But then I lost the following day.
You beat Moonglade, right? In,
yeah. Yeah,
in the finals.
Yeah.
That was so cool.
It was the peak of my career before it all went downhill. No,
now here you are, Cassin. Here you are in a hotel room with Tasos. What happened to you, man?
Got a lukewarm Heineken in my hand.
That's right. You
know. No, yeah, that was a cool event. You guys, did they take you down to the zoo?
Yeah, we did filming at the Sydney Zoo.
So, yeah, I remember they like showed like some clips of that and stuff.
So they did this whole. First of all, that was one of the most organized events I ever worked on. In my entire career, it was run by Nick Vanzetti.
Yep.
Who I believe later on ran a branch of ML.
He runs ESL,
Australia
now.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I thought for a second, I want to say MLG. I thought, no, that's
they
right.
Were the
Does he still run ESL Australia?
Yeah, they were still the Australian Cyber League back then. So this was back when they drove around
right.
in vans. They were a bunch of COD kids.
Right.
They'd started as. And they would like drive out in their vans and like unload their TVs in some hole. And they do like a COD competition. And then they added one or two other games. And they brought StarCraft on. Beginning of that year, I think, and
yeah.
And now they have an office with like 100 employees or something.
So great. Well, that guy was great at running the event. I mean, I've been to some total disaster, I guess, indie run events, but this guy was really on top of his stuff. And for B-roll, because the event was not very long, and kind of like we're hanging out here doing this podcast because we don't have much work.
Yeah.
On one of the days that I got in early, he sent Dan and me and a film crew to the Sydney Zoo, and. I don't think they really explained what or who we were, like Dan and me. And so I think they thought we were like like Animal Planet or Discovery Channel or something. And so they had booked.
So they gave you like full special treatment and stuff, kind of like.
They thought we were like nature show people. So they got me in the koala bear cage with this koala bear expert. And they just started filming. And I shouldn't.
Did it climb on you?
They didn't want it to climb on me because apparently they're kind of dangerous.
Yeah, they got pretty sharp claws. I guess
yeah.
they probably don't want you to get scratched.
Yeah,
up.
But I was there and they started filming and the lady's looking at me, this koala bear expert in Sydney, and I realized, oh, I better start asking questions. Like, I was asking her all these things about koala bears, how do they eat, and this was all just used for B-roll for a fucking computer game tournament. And we went and we had Dan Parrott sit with the emus because he kind of looks like an emu. We had a whole bunch of fun going around. That's a really cool zoo.
It's a really nice. You get like you come in on the ferry, right? You come
in
on the boat. Yeah. So you can see views all over the city. You can see the Harbour Bridge. That's a really nice zoo. Like normally someone comes to your city, you're not like, oh, I'll go to the zoo. But I'm like, no, I'll go to the zoo. It's actually like a nice spot to go.
Well, you guys got nothing but weird animals.
Dude, the
this is the closest thing to Jurassic Park we have.
Did you see a platypus?
I did see a platypus.
That's just my favorite animal. It's so ridiculous.
It's unreal.
They're like, mammals, you know, don't lay eggs except this one. It's like three types of animal combined in one. I think there's like a really good Douglas Adams quote where he's like, if you want proof that like God doesn't exist, it's like the platypus. He's like, look at this thing. It makes no sense
or
at all. Like,
the
he's
God like, is a monster.
Yeah, or that he was like really high that day or something. He's just like, I'm going to put like three of them together. And it's like, it's even got like poisonous barbs or something, I think, but it doesn't even use them for anything. And it's like, it's the most confusing animal.
Yeah. You know, the other time that I've been the closest to Australia or Australians in massive numbers was when I went to Bali.
Ooh, yeah.
Because.
Did you go down to Kuta?
I don't remember.
Would you go to like the really, really crowded part of Bali where there's like lots of just people kind of out clubbing?
It wasn't as crowded, but yeah. I mean, there was just you. It wasn't clear when you're in Bali if it's where Indonesians live or Australians live because there was so many people. Just all Aussies walking around, but they're Aussies that are totally different. Oh, I guess yeah. I'm trying to almost draw a comparison here to Disneyland. Or in Anaheim.
Are you trying to say it's the ones that we're embarrassed of?
I don't know.
Is that what you're trying to say, Nick? Because we are. Yes. Are yes, we are very embarrassed of... You know, it's a minority.
Yeah.
But it's a very loud minority. You know, people talk about, like, loud Americans. Like, you know, when they're with their tourists and they're, like, you know, 10 times louder than any other tourist just talking.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, these bogans, as we call them, are... 10 times Bogans. More obnoxious. Yeah, no, it's...
I learned that word the first time I came to Australia.
It's a good word.
Which bogan means like a... I guess we call him like a redneck in yeah. America or a hick or a hillbilly.
Kind of like, yeah, somewhere between like a chav and a redneck, I guess.
Yeah, I guess yeah. Lower income, more ruffian behavior, more...
Yeah, yeah, just a
much
bit...
Much more regional.
Bit more rough around the edges, I guess. We also, you know, we have like cashed up bogan is of course a term for... when people are kind of, you know, in the money, but the culture, I guess, hasn't quite caught up with it yet. So, I mean, Bali is really funny, though, because it's just one of these places where if you're in Australia, you don't have a lot of tourist destinations, right? You can go to New Zealand, their dollar's the same as ours, so you don't get any of that sweet, you know, exchange rate advantage.
Yeah, you don't get to be a rich person in a foreign country.
Exactly.
Feel. It's yeah. Like it's like if an American goes to Canada, it's not like...
It's yeah, like
my
yeah.
American money is going to get me very far here.
Exactly. But then when you go to somewhere where there's a big exchange rate difference, there's a big, obviously, cost of living difference as well, right? And then you go to Bali and everyone's like, oh my God, I can get a beer for a dollar. I can get me bintang.
Yeah.
And I can put on, you know, I can get my my cheap clothes for like a dollar and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, it's cool. I did go once with my girlfriend. We had a great time. There's a lot of good food there. There's a lot of beautiful parts of Bali that aren't completely crowded with tourists as well. But if you go to the main strip, it's like people get there. They're like, oh, wait, there's a beach here. It's nowhere near as good as like the beach in Sydney and back home, which is why I find it funny because there's all these Australians along the beach. And I'm like, most of the Australian beaches are better than this. Like,
yeah, when I was in Bali, I thought the beaches were going to be, I guess, a little bit better.
Yeah, I think
I might have not been in the right parts.
I've seen pictures of beautiful beaches there, but definitely not on the main tourist strip, right? And it's kind of inevitable. You've got that many people there. It's just going to get a little bit more polluted and stuff. But people are just like, hey, I can order a beer on the beach. Like, this is amazing. That's all they want. They just want to drink their beer on the beach, go to the pool, you know, pool, eat their buffet dinners. Bali's a nice place for that, but it's just so crowded. And because it's got such a tourist industry, I mean... You know, I don't like being a massive hipster and being like, oh, it's too touristy. It's not cool anymore. But there's a point where if you're a dude alone, even if you're with a girl or with a family, every second dude on the street is like, hey, boss, do you want drugs? You want cocaine? Viagra?
People kept trying to sell me drugs. I went down there with an ex-girlfriend a long time ago. I think I went to Bali maybe 5 years ago, but we got in some argument, right? Walking back to our Airbnb
with another tourist or
no, me and my girlfriend at the time were in an argument.
Oh right,
you know, and it's getting heated, and then this guy pulls up on a motorcycle. He's like, "You want some coke?" And I'm like, "No." I'm like, "Not now, dude. Not now." And then
he's like, "This is the time." Other people then, look at that, they're like, "I don't want to get involved." He's like, "No, man, that's a chance for a sale, right?"
And then another guy pulls up. He's like trying to give me drugs, and I go, "No." We're trying to like. Work it out. And then the third guy comes up and I'm like, no. Everybody's like, get out of here. Like, no.
You can't help but get aggressive after a while, man. I went there actually when a lot of the flights got canceled because the volcano was spewing up ash. So because of that, it wasn't nearly as crowded as it normally is. And we had like the taxi drivers and just generally all the dudes trying to sell drugs and anything were like, hey, man, crap, there's not a lot of tourists here. You know, we better be three times as aggressive. So I remember by like day two there, I'd be walking along the street and I'd just be like, no, leave me alone. No, leave me alone. Like I'd have to start growling at people because everyone was like, they'd follow you. They'd walk side by side. Be like, no, boss, come on. I'll drive you anywhere. Come on. You want girls? And it's just like, oh man, this is not what I'm here for. Like,
when you initially get somewhere, you go, wow, this is so crazy. But
yeah,
after that happens enough times, you go, no, I don't. I want to be left alone. I'm on vacation, but. Yeah, Bali's pretty cool. I would actually go back there, to be honest. I did like the people, and it was super cheap. But
I'd like to go back and just go, you know,
I think
avoid
you, I think
the
you
want to
get
packed.
Out of the tourist zones. Yeah, and go somewhere remote.
It's a good-sized island, and there's a lot of really lovely, like, resorts and just areas. So I've heard, like, there's nice diving there. I had a friend that did you can go up the volcano or the mountain or whatever in the center of it. Watch the sunset up there, you know, go through the rice paddies and all that sort of stuff. The stuff I didn't do. I'm like, yeah, that's the stuff I should have done.
Well, the
when
first
I was
time
there.
I went, I think I was too chicken to kind of go somewhere deep that was not like close to the city and close to, you know, hotels. But I think if I went again, I'd probably make it more remote. But I guess Australians end up there because it's the only place that's close. And yeah. I guess for you working in esports, especially as somebody who has to travel a decent amount. I feel like Australia might be, I guess maybe New Zealand a little bit more so, but the most difficult place to work in.
One of the most isolated in the world.
Yeah, the most to work in esports internationally where there's events all over the Americas.
I think if you're in like South Africa or like Argentina, you might have just as hard a time with like direct flights to places, but... It is, dude, you get used to the travel, you know, we're always joking about it, you know, we always say we've got to transfer through the moon, you know, we've got to get NASA just to get out of our country, we've got to go
crazy.
To the upside down and go through some sort of
time portal.
I think
I need NASA to open up this fucking beer bottle. I'm trying to get this beer bottle to crack open the...
Oh, that's, I always fuck that one up. I am terrible at opening.
All right, you want to watch it here, just stay where you are. I'm going to show you a trick. I can open this beer bottle against the drawer.
I'll live commentate it for the listeners. All right, so Nick's standing up. And he's going over to a drawer. He's got one of these nice little metal handles.
Ready?
Yep. And just like that, do you want to open another one straight? Open another one straight away for me, just so we don't have to get up again. Awesome. Thanks, man. Just cracking it, popping it off on the drawer. Nice.
Let me just get my headset back on here.
So the first one that Nick tried to do there for those listening is he tried to just crack it off on the side of the table on the corner.
I was actually trying to use my bottle to crack it open. On the other bottle, but it just sounded like there was jingle bells in the background, probably for the people listening. I've seen people do it before. These are one of these ones you're supposed to have a bottle opener, but I don't have one for.
Last time I tried to do that, one bottle and the other, I actually like slipped it. Like I bent the lid half off, but it didn't come off. Because it like slipped, it like sliced my hand open a little bit, gave me like a pretty good cut.
No.
And I was like, this is the most embarrassing injury I've ever got. Like,
this is
like,
the most dangerous part.
I failed to open the beer bottle and I cut my hand. I'm like, yeah, all right. Well, this is really, really proud Australian here, man. Like, I'm doing well for my country. Oh my God.
So, I mean, how do you handle the commute to an event? I mean, this is probably one of the closer ones to home, but I mean, you do a lot of work in Europe.
Yeah, I used to fly to Europe a lot. It's
how do you
rough.
Handle that?
You know, it's funny, I guess, to put it in perspective for people. It's minimum about 21 hours to get over to Europe, right? So you've got to, you know, that's the long trips. If we get a direct one, if I go to Shanghai or Seoul, like where we just went, that was a 11 or 12 hour direct flight. And I just go, that's awesome. Anything direct, like, I do not care about. Same with LA, 14 hours direct. I'm like, nope, easy. Like, that's nothing.
Damn,
but
it's 14 hours?
Yeah.
LA?
Yeah, I did Dallas, 16 hours as well, 1 year. Yeah, it depends. And because it's so far, if you go, I think it's west to east is where you, because of the rotation of the Earth, you're going with the rotation. So you've got to go further. Because the Earth is rotating with your destination away from you, right? So you actually end up with like an hour time difference in the flight time just because of the Earth is rotating Whereas the other way, you're going, you know, the Earth is kind of speeding up your journey because it's turning underneath your flight and your destination's actually coming closer to you. So, like, if you just hovered up in the same spot and waited long enough, your destination would come underneath you, right?
Yeah. Weren't they trying to get some kind of plane that would go up so high?
Oh, that it would have, like, less...
Yeah, it would be, like, an hour or two to get to almost anywhere.
And I guess it would also just be less resistance, right? Because yeah, you'd basically almost go into space. Yeah, like the old spy planes, right?
Yeah.
That would be friggin' sick, man. I dream about Concorde's coming back, you know, the supersonic...
Yeah, well, they couldn't do them, right, because they would destroy all the windows in the areas when they...
I'm speaking so far out of school.
I don't know.
I think that's a myth.
Is that not true?
No, maybe there was something like that. I don't know.
I can't fact check it while we're doing this.
I think that was a Superman movie. We're like, Cobra Venom. Can you look that one up? Oh, Matt's not here. Okay. Yeah. Like, wait. This is not the pylon show. yeah. Basically, that was two of them crashed, and they couldn't figure out why. Why? There was like one of them crashed, and heaps of people died on it. A Concorde jet. And they couldn't figure out why. And then there was another one that had a failure, and they were like, oh, we just need to get rid of the entire line of passenger jets. Because they could carry, I think, like 80 or 100 people.
Yeah.
But because of fuel, it could only do like New York to London. That was like the maximum distance, I think. But it would get there in like 2 hours or something. Like, it was incredibly fast. Because you're actually
bringing that shit back.
And it was very quiet as well when you're on it. If you're outside, it was super loud.
Yeah.
But when you're on it, because you actually outrun your own sound. So it would be way more quiet than the planes that we're on, because we're traveling slower than sound usually, I believe, on the current planes.
Yeah.
I think so. This is something I read a long time ago. Likewise, not fact-checked. Someone, I'm sure...
We say shit wrong all the time on here. I mean, normally we have a third person here, you know, who's using the laptop to fact-check stuff, but we're on our own here, so our dumbness is just going to be exposed in this case.
But back to the point, right? The question,
mm-hmm.
How to deal with long flights. I'm actually a massive, massive nerd on this because when you, I mean, you've traveled a lot. When you get there, mm-hmm. You feel bad. There's nothing that motivates me more than feeling like utter shit about something, right? Like, you know, when you hit rock bottom, right? So I don't know. At some point, obviously after having too many drinks and being hungover on a plane and like wanting to die, I've steadily developed a bunch of things I do to actually make it a lot better. The biggest one is squats on the plane. I like to actually like work out.
Oh, you
bit.
Get up.
Yep.
Dude, I do some of that kind of stuff too.
I am the most embarrassing person on the plane. Like, you need to really just, because no matter what, you're blocking the flight attendants as they're coming past. They're looking at you funny. Often they'll start talking to me. They'll be like, what are you doing? And I'll be like, I'm making sure I don't die from blood clots, but I'm also just making sure I can sleep. Because after I've been in that chair for 6 hours, I cannot sleep anymore. I can't sit comfortably. I'm squirming. But if you get up and you stretch, and I'll try to do a full stretching as much as I possibly can in the space. I'll try to like get down and stretch my groin out as well, which sounds weird, but...
No, that feels good.
It's really, really powerful. But yeah, and then I'll do like squats and like maybe some lunges, and I'll try to do like just calf raises and things like that. And I find being able to do that, I'll do like marching on the spot, like, you know, when you lift your like knees up really high and stuff. If I can just do that, get my blood pressure up, get the blood flowing, I can actually like sleep probably about double as long on my flights.
How long do you sleep for?
It's very, you know, shitty sleep, but sometimes 8 hours. Usually I'd say 5 to 6 if it's like a nighttime flight.
You sleep well normally in a bed?
I do. I do sleep pretty well. More issues as I get older, I find, but...
Really?
Very closely related to diet and like exercise. Like if I'm eating unhealthy and I'm not exercising, I sleep a lot worse. There's like a very direct correlation there.
Yeah, I absolutely find if I'm exercising, I sleep amazingly. It's especially if I have,
so
if I have no
better.
Alcohol, I just sleep better.
Dude.
But I find on a flight, I want to have drinks because I'm trying to cope with the boredom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I will have at most one drink these days. I used to drink a lot more when I was flying. And I will, like, if I'm with someone and, you know, we're going to chat, I might have a few red wines or a few beers or something, but... Otherwise, it's I try to have either none or just like one drink is nice to like relax you to go to sleep. Like I really like if you've got a nighttime flight, dinner, red wine, instantly go to sleep, you know, before the tray's even gone from in front of you, that sort of thing. I play a lot of video games on flights as well, actually. So that really passes the time.
And that was my plan on this flight. I actually tweeted out requesting games that you can play on a laptop.
Yeah.
And I downloaded a bunch, and then my plug on the airplane didn't work.
You mentioned this yesterday. Dude, I had the exact same experience. And it's like a universal plug. It's got the green light on it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're like, oh, I know there's power here. And you get really excited. I had the same thing on two Air Canada flights recently where I plugged it in. Yeah. And then I was like an hour and a half into gaming and my battery just turned off. No. And I was like, what?
No, this is what happened to me is I was getting into, I got Hollow Knight. And I got some other games too.
I've got that as well. My friend
recommended really
that.
It looked really cool. Well, I couldn't tell you how good it was because my fucking the fucking plug wouldn't work. I was maybe 30 minutes into it, and then I got a warning that my PC was about to turn off, and I said, whoa. It was all plugged in. I went to the stewardess, and then she plugged her thing in there. It didn't work.
Yeah.
And then they brought me to another seat. I plugged it in, and it didn't work.
That's ridiculous.
And they said they tested it. I just thought, all right, I'm just going to...
That's so weird. I had the exact same thing. I tried it on multiple seats. I was like, it's not just this one. I don't know. And I was...
How is that possible on an airplane that they don't have the...
You're in business as well, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was like, oh, I bet they've just turned it off for like economy, like on the flight I was on, right? But if you're in business, I'm like, wait, come on. Like, this is a pretty important part of why you want a business ticket is you want to be able to like set yourself up.
No, exactly. It was weird, man. Are you economy or economy plus flying out of Australia? Or do you do business ever?
No, I've only had one upgrade to business ever, and it ruined me for like my next five flights because I was like, ah, I'm back in a crappy seat, man. I remember it was like a Finnair flight for like 12 hours, and I was like, they're just like, oh, you've been upgraded to business. And I was like, oh, it was like Singapore to Helsinki. And yeah, it was, dude, just having the bed to stretch out on makes such a big difference.
Yeah, no, it makes a huge difference. I got business class. Let me think here. I've had it for, it's 2019 now. I've had it for almost the entirety of when GSL started.
Oh, damn. That's a long time.
Yeah, we did. Here's how it worked is nobody wanted to give it to us. And then NASL, because we had already got our rates where we wanted. So then there was too many tournaments at the time, because this is when StarCraft II was the biggest, asking for Dan and me to do stuff.
Yeah, you guys were doing a tournament every weekend.
Yeah, it was crazy.
For a while there. It was...
And we thought, okay, NASL, these guys work in L.A., so they're used to people asking for more than what's normal, right? Yeah. You know, at least if I make a big request to a company in Los Angeles, they're not going to just say no.
Yeah.
So they said, are you sure business? So we said, yeah. Then we got MLG to say yes because they were competing with NASL. And I said, and they're the New York company. I go, why the fuck am I going to work with you guys?
Yeah.
If this company is already doing that, we'll just work with them. Then they give it to me. Then that made ESL fold in contracts. And then that finally got Blizzard.
Yeah.
It was the hardest one to get. And then we just basically, if they don't give us business class, we just don't go. But
yeah.
I think that I got it in a very specific period of time.
Yeah.
Where I was able to follow the momentum of the game itself.
Well, I mean, you're also the biggest names, like you and Dan, right? Well, you guys still are in StarCraft, of course. Though esports has turned into this crazy huge thing, right?
A lot of other games out there now.
There's a lot of famous people from esports right now, man. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's like it's one of those things, right, where you actually check that the organization is legit as well, because they need to get the flight beforehand, right? So. You've worked with dozens of organizations you've never heard of before, right? Especially back in the day, it was like people would just spring up and they're like, we want to make of an esports tournaments. And you're like, oh, this person doesn't know what they're talking about, you know?
Yeah. Or they have some pie in the sky. And you go, oh, I don't know.
Like, we want e-gamers to become the new athlete. And you're like, what are we talking about, man? But then they're like, you know, we'll pay your rate. It's all good. And obviously back then, you know, especially before the big boom with StarCraft, which you experienced, work was scarce, right? So you'd accept it from anyone.
Right.
To some extent, and you'd get burnt, right? Everyone has stories of the early days. You'd work with these companies and like you get there and your hotel room is like a shack or something, or it's like, you know, got holes in the wall or some scary hostel.
Yeah, you get down to an event and you go, oh no.
Yeah.
This venue isn't right. You meet the two or three people organizing it and you realize that these people couldn't possibly be in charge of anything. And then you think, are they going to pay me?
Yeah.
You know, because I've had a couple events early on in my career that I just didn't get paid for.
Yeah, dude. I mean, that's a common story that went around for a long time, right?
Yeah.
There was like many times because... As a contractor, I mean, there's people out there who work with big companies, ones that we work with and know as well, where sometimes you still don't get paid. And like, if you don't chase it up, it's like a year later and you're like, wait, this invoice never got paid. You know, you're checking your finances. You're like, oh, I didn't follow that up. I assumed that company would pay that. And you're like, they're like, oh, like your invoice was missing this. And you're like, oh, but like no one told me that or contacted me. They just said, yeah, that'll get paid. And like, people wouldn't reach out.
Well, it's also,
so that can happen with a big company that's legit, in quotation.
Well, it's also
marks.
You have to be very on top of who paid you what, which is another kind of weird, weird burden where...
Well, it's funny. If the legit companies aren't keeping track of it and making sure they pay you out, and then you start working with these shady newer characters who don't have a proper accountant, right? It's like it's like a one-dude operation, or it's like a startup where there's a guy who's like, oh, he's like so swamped, he's just forgetting half the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to differentiate when you're in that environment, this kind of Wild West situation as a contractor where it's like, oh, is this a dodgy person, or are they just an overworked person, or did this just slip through the cracks? Because... I mean, there have been times with Blizzard and other companies where I'm like, oh, I just didn't get paid for this event. And then, you know, you chase it up and it always gets sorted. But then you do that with one of
like,
these
like, I never
have
to worry about Blizzard just not paying me.
Of course.
But, and I have no problems with them now. I think they have a good automated system now that it always
gets
through.
It's much more automated these days.
But at the time, especially in early StarCraft II, I think everybody was kind of figuring out how to do this.
Yeah.
And how to get it taken care of.
Do you remember ESL Pro Gamer prizes back in the day?
Yeah, there was this whole thing going on with ESL. Now, I never was a pro gamer that competed in an ESL tournament. And certainly, I didn't have any ESL prize money owed to me. But there was a lot of stuff going on where they were late
My first tournament was at NIEM, and I got the prize money, I think it was a year and a half later.
Fuck.
And it's like they obviously have a thousand times better as an organization, but that's like such a respected organization, right?
Yeah.
And they started copping a lot of crap for that in like late 2012.
They have some weird model for even getting paid.
Yeah.
Which I still am always confused about. I mean, when you do events for them, don't you have to like I don't want to.
Oh, like the invoice system? Yeah,
invoice system.
They set up a new weird invoice system.
And then
you
send it into some thing, and then it's they like come back and they say this isn't.
They've outsourced their accounting.
By,
But it's like a super automated, like very. You do one small detail wrong, and then like.
And they just send it back and say. And we're talking about these invoices you have to fill out, which, I mean, generally speaking, with most companies, an invoice doesn't have to be that complex for
what
we're
doing.
Oh, this is
like, you need their address, you need their tax number in Europe, they need that. You need their VAT verification. Normally, it's like, you're literally just like, I did work, here's the money, here's my payment details. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And theirs is very strict, and it'll go back and forth, and then you'll contact ESL directly, and they'll just tell you to go back to the...
Back to the automated
format. The automated format, and then,
This is like support in 2019, right? It's like, you're like, oh, I need to call this company to get my credit card sorted out, and they're like, you can't find the number anywhere, because they're just like, oh, you're like, well, here's our FAQ on the website. You're like, no, phone number, and it's like, it just keeps taking you back in this circle of like, web chat, you know, talk to a robot. Does this answer your... You're like, no! But yeah, I think it's kind of funny, because back in the day, everything was so, so disorganized. But yeah, things are a lot better than they were. Like, it's a much more stable esports environment to work in these days, right?
Yeah, everything is a lot better now.
It's mostly actually, like, low-end pro gamers you hear getting screwed around, right? Because they jump on these like kind of fake teams and stuff. Like, I don't really hear of much.
So
talent
I never know much about teams.
Yeah,
I mean, when I was on teams as a player, I mean, obviously there was no money for being on the team. You know,
oh,
it was more of a...
I never got a salary in my whole
a
career.
Clan or what you want to call a group of guys practicing together and then trying to go take on another team in some team match. But it does seem like if you're a young pro gamer, there's definitely a lot of completely shitty team owners that don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that type of role can tend to attract scumbags, middlemen.
Well, especially like it's just when something's hot, right?
And
it's
right.
Like,
well, you got a couple factors. You got young people who are the talent.
Yeah, and they're
very
easy
young,
to take advantage of.
And they're also, not by any fault of their own, not going to know easily if they're being taken advantage of or not.
You're just not a good judge of character when you're young. It's like, very few people are.
And also, you're some kid who's saying, I just want to play games. You've probably gotten a lot of pushback from other people in your life, and then some other adult comes in and says, don't worry about it, dude. I'll take care of it. And you think, okay, good. Now I can get back on my computer game.
Yeah.
And then...
The last thing you want to do as a pro is be thinking about all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, I've met some really cool team owners, But I've also met ones where...
Well, there have been times where... Yeah,
I leave with raised eyebrows.
It's like, you know how like there's like Silicon Valley and there's like these startups that just basically they're there just to try to get the investors in for like a round of funding and then kind of bail, basically. Yeah. And they're like, oh, we got paid. It's cool. Like the product was never really... I guess the best example is like all these crypto... They're like, oh, we're making a crypto blockchain solution.
Oh, there's
just like
a lot of that in
buzzwords.
Yeah.
And you're like, this is not even a product. Like, what's the company? And you're like, oh, you're just trying to get like, you know, unsavvy investors in because it's a hot space.
Right.
The moment something becomes hot, people want to get in there. And it's like a very low form of that, right? You've got these people who are like, I'm going to scam $1,000 or $5,000 here and there.
Or this kid
yeah.
makes this much money. If we take a cut of that, and you know, we do...
And then he explodes. We got it on contract. We can like take 10% and stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because you read the contracts, right? And this has been happening more and more. People are leaking these contracts or there's a dispute and they just
put it out
publicly.
Some of these contracts are fucking
They wouldn't
jokes.
Hold up in court at all. Like, no. They're ridiculous. It's like, I'm pretty sure like all the judge would do is yell at like the company. He'd be like, this is disgusting. Like this can't stand. This is, you know, just unable to stand up. You know, and then it always comes out like, oh, well, you know, you got to get your lawyers to read your contracts. And it's like, hey, you're starting out as
a
pro gamer. You don't have a lawyer, man.
Most lawyers don't know anything about esports either.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a huge issue is that, you know, I've had this experience with agents or trying to talk to who I don't have an agent now. And when I had an agent, I made less money.
Yeah.
And this guy seemed like he did know esports and he was actually a fucking moron.
Yeah.
Like he didn't even know how to negotiate my own pay to where it was before, and then the moment I fired him, I got my pay back up to where it was, where I think, why was I giving you any of my money? But I've had it where, so like when I had an agency, when by the way, I didn't get paid for tens of thousands of dollars. This guy teamed up with an actual sports agent who was a big poker player agent, and that guy was somebody who actually got poker players contracts and money. But then that guy doesn't know anything about gaming, what my work looks like. For instance, there would be a question, well, what if you did a whole bunch of circuits on, you know, talk TV shows? Can you go around and chat up? And I go, well, I would miss all my shows in Korea. I can't do that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, what about this? What about that? Well, we can sort of do that, but...
They've got this idea. They're like, oh, we're going to turn you into a star and we're just going to take this template from poker and we're going to copy paste it onto you.
Yeah,
right?
Or even worse, like, from like acting, like what movie actors do, which, and those people have, oh, hold on. Sorry, my girlfriend's trying to call on. I got to X this off. I cannot talk to her right now.
Whoa.
I will call her.
You just X your girlfriend's call for me?
Well, we're still recording, yeah. And I also don't know what that's going to do to the audio here if I hit yes. Anyways, I will call her after.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah, sorry. The call was coming on my laptop where I'm like, I don't know what that is. If we're having this recording going, I don't know what that does.
Man.
Anyways, I mean, they had this whole format that just didn't work. And
well, it's lazy, right? They're trying to basically be like, hey, we've got a business that works this way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can take that, put no new work into like innovating it or changing it. We just will use it, and hopefully it'll just work with your thing without us actually checking out how that industry works, right? And that's just lazy. And it's like, hey, let's just see if we can put no investment in and take a cut of this new market, which is shitty business, right? Especially when their whole job should be expanding your income and your career, right? An agent's job should always be, hey, I want to take 10% or 20% or whatever the number is.
Yeah.
But I obviously I'm going to be confident. Any pitch from an agent is, I'll get you 50% more income.
Dude,
so,
this guy
know,
promised
yeah.
me, he was. This was early on in my career. He goes, I can get you on private jets.
Oh my God.
And at the time I thought,
good.
And I had just gotten on business class, right? So I thought,
yeah.
Okay, well, that's another step. But by the end, we didn't get fucking paid Dan or me. And then they even got shitty at the end. He's like, well, I helped make you guys. And
what?
Oh, yeah. And then you know, we told him to fuck off.
God.
And then it, like, as he left, then my income started to go back up.
That's insane.
And I go, oh, my God. What a fucking colossal waste of time. I guess it was a good thing in a way because I got to realize, A, there's more things I can do on my own.
Yeah.
But then, B, I can't just trust people. I think at the time
it was like kind of like it's if it looks too good to be true, like you may be like it was one of those things, like, because yeah. I think I met the guy and he was a very good salesperson,
yeah,
like very very great speaker. And there's a certain people that have charisma and can get you excited about something, and mm-hmm. sometimes it's like one of those things where you need to, like, I don't know, I guess take a step back, right? But it's easy in hindsight to say that and be like, oh, actually, like do you reckon you saw the warning signs a bit earlier? Or
the only thing that I thought should have been a warning was that he used to run a strip club. he owned a strip club, and I thought, but at the time I thought, oh, I'm open-minded, whatever. You know, I thought, okay, was it successful? I later found out it actually wasn't, but I was sold so many ideas. And
I'm just imagining like a strip club DJ. He's like, and now we have the lovely Nick Papatassis.
And I'm out there twerking, trying to get my appearance fees up. I mean, at the time, it's cringy to talk about, right, when you say that, because first of all, he was saying nightclub early on, I'm not computing that.
Mm.
And then like a year or two in, I'm like, oh, he meant strip club. And I go, oh, okay, because I was thinking... You know what I'm talking about?
Course, like, yeah. You're thinking it's a cool place where you spend $1,500 on a bottle of Dom Perignon, and
you have
a nice booth, and there's some DJ in there who's like world class and stuff. Right. You're not thinking of like, you know.
But I think what happened was is I had, you know, early on in my career trusted Dan, for instance, who was just another guy out in Korea. I thought, okay, we're going to make this work. Working with Dan is amazing. And we got this thing going. I thought, okay, then we'll have a third person come in and manage us, and this will just work out fine because this person should work hard too.
And this was also at a point in your career. You guys were so busy because you were so hot at that time with StarCraft.
We were
so,
overworked. Yeah.
So if someone comes in and is like, hey, I can take away handling that, like, I'm sure you know the feeling of, like, you open your email inbox and there's like hundreds of emails and you can't tell, like we were talking before, you know, how can you tell if an org is legit or not? Because there might be orgs that come out and I've never heard of these guys. They might be willing to pay double your rate without even blinking, you know?
No, like, exactly.
So you need someone to filter that for you at that time when you're so busy. So,
that, too. But then you have these companies where it takes weeks to negotiate before the event.
Yeah.
And you're doing it back and forth, and you're already at another event. You're like casting, and then on the commercial break, trying to answer an email yourself.
And negotiating, and negotiating, well. I'm worth this much. Like, you know, anytime you're like trying to negotiate, it's an awkward thing. And you guys were doing that for so many events that it was literally insane.
It was not sustainable at the time.
Yeah,
I'm actually glad things slowed down.
Oh, of course.
And we were able to kind of get it sorted a little bit better.
Well, I was literally early this week. I was thinking about the old days and the first times I met you and Dan. Like, that was right when you guys were really stressed, like late 2012.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, these guys are the funniest guys ever, and they're great, and I love them.
Oh, thank you, man.
At the same time, I remember you know, everything being very intense, and there was a bit more of an intense energy about you guys because you were just like, oh, yeah, it's like a fifth flight this like week, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, we're going from here to here. Like, all right. Like, you know, I need a beer in me just to like relax at the end of a day.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, everything was crazy because you guys were doing so many events. I met you first. Actually, it was at that Australian event. You know, when you guys.
That was actually that time, again, one of the best events ever because it was so well run.
Which was awesome. And I think I remember because I went straight to IEM Cologne after that. So we flew, and you were the same. So we all went Sydney to Cologne.
That was for Gamescom, right?
Yeah, for Gamescom 2012. And then I think you guys had like another event somewhere else, and then you went back to Korea. And I was already like, oh man, I had this big championship in my hometown. And then I went to Germany, and then I went home. And then I was like, oh my God, this is a lot of travel and stuff. And you guys, like, that was every weekend for you guys. It was just insane.
It was definitely unhealthy.
Yeah.
I think now that things are more streamlined with StarCraft, and I think just with all games in general, it's more manageable. But at that time, I think StarCraft was some kind of like a esports guinea pig freak.
Yeah,
that they, you know, it was the first big one globally.
Well, it was
StarCraft 2, I should say.
Streaming getting big as well. Like, that's it. It wasn't. It was esports was having a resurgence. Streaming was exploding with Justin TV and then Twitch TV for the first time. And you guys are at the kind of the center of this crazy, like, everyone's like, oh, we want to get in on this market. It's so hot right now. And I mean, it just created a lot of action, right? Everyone wanted a piece. And that's stressful.
Yeah, it was stressful. It's funny because, like, now when I do my job, I'm so relaxed.
Hmm.
And even though Blizzard has had a series of just PR nightmares, I'm actually still just not as stressed, or not stressed in the same way I was in the kind of chaos. of early StarCraft and trying to figure out where's my place and am I doing this right? Did you have any kind of stress when, like, as a pro gamer, you weren't good enough or that you weren't on the right team or what?
Yeah, I mean, dude, that's its whole story. I've changed so much as a person since I became a commentator 4 years ago. Four and a bit years ago. Less than 4.5 years ago, right? Because it's been a whole new chapter in my life. But before that, it was the pro gaming chapter. And oh my God. Dude, it's like, you know, you just have no money. It's like starving artist. Like, you know, it's like legit like that where, you know, there's so much I learned from trying to be a StarCraft pro. And I ultimately failed at being a StarCraft pro. Like, I look at someone like Snoop.
Really? You would view it as a failure?
Like, in terms of, was I able to afford enough to live and make, like, a proper career of it? No. No. And because it was so hard to do that from Australia at the time, as well as with no history in competitive RTS, right? So as someone who was, like, did it right, I think of Moonglade. You know Moonglade's story, right? Where he played Warcraft 3 for many years, always went to WCG, was always Australia's number one player, take maps off the best guys over there. He was never a world-class player because he didn't live over there, you know, play the regular circuit events, but he'd still be, you know, one of, well, by far the best RTS player.
And this was also him being in the shadows of Legionnaire,
yep.
Who was a StarCraft 1 pro who did go to Korea and had
played there for a few years in the very early days.
Quite a good amount of success. I think beat Slayer's Boxer on TV.
Yeah.
Had, I think, the world record for Reaver. Kills,
yes,
with a Reaver.
Reaver kill. It was many years later, someone overtook him. And his record was in a PvP, if I remember correctly.
I think it was a PvZ. Was it?
I think it got overtaken by a PvZ. And that's why it was like, I think it was like actually a crazy amount of kills, Jesus, from a Reaver drop in a PvP, I think.
Wow. Okay.
I would need to look it up.
I'm not sure either.
There's a Brood War nerd out there who's Googling it and posting it in the comments, I'm sure. But yeah, like absolute trailblazer. You go back and watch the Legionnaire videos, which there's not that many of because it's pre-YouTube, right? So you can't find too many. But that's like when they're wearing like space suits and stuff. They got like these weird outfits. Like they're doing the stage that's in the audience.
This is
it's
before
like
Korea had
up.
Even figured out how to.
They were experimenting,
right.
Yeah. They were figuring out esports for the first time.
But basically, Moonglade was living in this guy's shadow, and Warcraft 3 was the game that came after StarCraft 1.
Yeah, and he was over there in Brisbane just playing, and he saw StarCraft 2 coming out, similar to you guys, right? You prepared to cast StarCraft 2 and be the commentators. He prepared to be a StarCraft 2 top pro gamer. He said, look, with Warcraft, I was never able to be a Todd or a Grubby who were living in China and flying all around the world, so... I remember he talked a lot. It was like the interview with It Me JP. JP. He did that years ago and talked about it. And he was like, yeah, 6 months before, nonstop training, quit his job. He was playing Brood War like full time basically to prepare for StarCraft 2. He got to like A on IC Cup and stuff. Just an incredibly talented player who put all this focus into preparing. He had this rich RTS history, which decades of experience, like it adds up, right? If you just get into an RTS game and go full time, you can't be pro in a year. Like,
no, I think that's physically impossible.
It's not possible. You don't understand enough. You haven't played across enough metas, strategic diversity, all that sort of stuff. So it was fascinating what he did, where he prepared so well for this. And I was just so impressed when he was talking through how he did that. And when he came out, he was one of the big guys from the very start of StarCraft 2. And I was always a little bit sad that he had some rough experiences overseas and with teams and stuff to the point where he, you know, kind of retired from it and pulled back from it, where he could have, you know, had a massive stream. He could still have won more tournaments, you know, if he had wanted to and still had the passion for the game. But he was like, not as interested in the game and went back and you know, went down a different path. But he just is unmatched in Australian esports history. No one's done what Moonglade did. And I look at that and I go, that's awesome. That's what I wish I had done. But for me, it was like StarCraft 2 came out and I was like, oh, dude, I used to love playing Warcraft Ladder. Let's play StarCraft Ladder. And, you know, you're kind of like, oh, now I'm playing a lot. Ooh, now I'm skipping a class. And then, like, you know, you kind of fall into it. You're not organized. You're not like an adult with a coaching regimen or a practice thing. So for me, I was always kind of trailing the pack. And then playing from Australia, this was in a time where you had to pay your way to every tournament, even if you're a top pro. Part of being on a team was they paid your travel, right?
And that seems like it would just be fiscally impossible.
The amount of money that was from Australia for travel is just crazy, man. So yeah, I would put all of my budget that I would get from sponsors, and I would do all this sponsor stuff to try to get more money just so I could put it towards travel budget, right? And there was, you know, pro gamers at my level trying to come up who were getting, you know, 500 euros or 1,000 euros a month during the peak of StarCraft, you know, and living where they could get on a bus and go to the big tournaments, right? For me, it was like, oh, I had to, you know, spend all this money to go live overseas for a few months so I could play a bunch of tournaments. And I never got successful in any of them. Like, I got to the edge of being like, oh, I'm a legitimate pro player, right? And then all the guys who I was practicing with, they ended up all coming into the real heart of their success 2015, 2016, 2017. And some of them are still playing. You know, Showtime was coming up around the time I was ending my career.
That's right, yeah.
You know, Euthermal, Harstam, sort of. All these guys I used to practice with, you know, they all taught me a lot about the game from chatting to them and stuff. So it's been awesome to watch them become such great players. But for me, I hit a point where I had tried really hard 2014. And I like lived in Europe and I tried to basically compete in a bunch of dream hacks and I qualified for a Gfinity. And basically I just got my ass whooped by MC at like four of these tournaments and he eliminated me and like one or two other really good pros. And I just couldn't pull it together on the stage. And it was one of those things where it was like, because in the lead up to that, you know, I wasn't full time. I was always like doing coach in a pay rent and I was doing this like sponsor stuff and I was a disorganized person. Like where if I went back, I'd be like, man, you got to be more organized. Like you got to work out. Here's your training regimen, you know? So I was always like just short of being able to do it where I remember I got back from this trip and I was at the peak skill I'd ever been because all I'd done was play StarCraft for 4 months and I was like winning all these online tournaments, but I couldn't afford to go any big LAN tournaments anymore. And I was like, oh, and I had to become a streamer and start kind of working down that different avenue. So I see that as having failed. Whereas I see someone like Moonglade who actually won tournaments and got very high placings internationally, made it to top eights and top fours and things. I see that as like he made it as a pro gamer at one of the hardest times to do it.
But so, he became a caster in Korea and you're a caster.
He did as well.
So you view him as a success, but you view yourself somehow.
No, I think I view myself as very successful and very lucky and blessed. Like, I'm very happy with where I am right now. But I just think as a player, his career was much more successful. And I think there's, like, a lot of other players who've built a legacy where they've said, like, I'm earning a solid income, I can pay rent, I'm saving money for the future. That's, like, you're a real pro gamer who's made it, in my opinion. I'm not saying someone who's not making a lot of money isn't a pro gamer. They absolutely are. But they haven't made it as a pro gamer, right? They haven't made it into, like, a career that's sustainable in
some way. So what you're saying is basically, when you get a pro gamer who's made enough money that it can sustain himself and propel him into more of the things that he wants, that's in a lot of ways making it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you need to at least like make as much as a full-time McDonald's employee. You know, like
it's,
and a lot of pro gamers don't. And I never got to that point where I made as much as a full-time McDonald's employee. Not in Australia anyway, maybe overseas.
I mean, I certainly never did with StarCraft 1 where it was and where in the world I was, but
I mean, even in my time, which is not that many years ago, I would have had to win every Australian tournament. And even then, I still would be like not making that much. So for me, my goal was always, you know, I need to get to quarterfinals of international tournaments, hopefully some semifinals. That's the point where, and even that would have not really been cutting it because I don't know if you remember the prize money 5 years ago, 6 years ago, but you'd, I mean, I always tell this story when people complain about WCS and it being a welfare system. They're like, oh, they're just giving free money. They don't even let the Koreans play. Snoot, you look at his tournament brackets from 2014, and it's like one of the most comical things you'll ever see. You're like, oh, he beat like three GSL champions and five other really good Code-S Koreans, and he got to the top eight and won €1,000.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, this guy beat eight of like these amazingly talented players and he got €1,000? That's it? Like, it is mind-blowing how little money there was for a lot of these prize pools. It was like $10,000 first place. Whereas
and
nowadays,
it was very
it's like
competitive back then, too.
Incredibly competitive. There was too many pro gamers. There was hundreds. There was probably 500 pro gamers around the world competing for like $2 million of prize money.
Yeah, there was definitely
That's
some
not
bloat
sustainable.
At
it
the
was
time.
Insane.
Yeah.
It was too much of a hot thing, right? Everyone wanted a piece. And the money caught up later, which has been a lot nicer. We have a smaller pool of pro gamers, which a lot of people are not happy about. But in terms of sustainability and at least the top 20 guys, top 50 guys being able to make a really good living, we're much more at that point now. Whereas before, you'd have some really good players and they just like were like making so little money, it wasn't worth them to keep doing it. So that was a very hard time to make it as a StarCraft pro gamer. At the same time, I think I absolutely could have done it if I was like much more driven, organized human. You know, like, you know, if The Rock was put into like my shoes, he would have absolutely won international tournaments playing from Australia. He wouldn't have
oh, you mean just because of how organized and
how much of a, you know, like those really driven, organized, successful, smart people.
Do you think that's a shtick though? There's a whole Look, I know The Rock looks amazing.
I mean, obviously, the guy's a machine,
but I just always wondered.
I'm not saying he would be a great StarCraft player necessarily, but I mean, if I had his mentality, I mean, and obviously he's a bit of a meme with this because we all joke about like The Rock, and I listen to Joe Rogan. We were laughing about this earlier, and he's always going on about The Rock as like this superhuman warrior and stuff
who carries his own gym with him wherever he goes in a
gets to the hotel
van.
And does 600 push-ups, man. But yeah, like I think it's one of those things where I just look back and see how much I could have improved on.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously, there's always limitless room for improvement, right, in our life at all stages. But I just look at it, and I think there's a few very big fundamental things I could have done a lot better with my physical health, my mental training, and trying to, you know, read some more books on sports psychology. I think that's, like, really important that a lot of players neglect, and I was really bad at. I was very good at tilting and, like, throwing games and giving up free first maps of a series and then going on tilt.
That's, I think, a big one for a lot of players. It's a bad...
Yeah. I mean,
Bad state of mind.
Some of them levitate their keyboards. I don't know if you saw the gif of Drogo.
I haven't seen this. It was just
the greatest one. Drogo's really, he's my favorite because he does get very angry, but he makes a lot of fun of himself about it as well. So he actually was like, basically what happened was the other player, it was a laser did the dirtiest cheese. One of these ones where, you know, there's the mineral walls you can mine out.
Sure, of course.
He like mined through and just did this like dirty speedling all in where like Drogo was walling off the front of his base because he knew there was a speedling all in coming. And he just like, it was one of these brand new maps he's played hardly any games on. And he's got like this really thick double wall and the Ling's just like run into his base and he's like, oh. And like the camera goes to him and he like punches his keyboard and it like floats into the air and it like hovers for like a whole, it was like it levitated for like half a second. It was just the funniest thing ever. But that's it, man. There's like StarCraft is one of the most brutal games as well for tilting you. Like you can die to so many things.
Well, that's like the whole experience of trying to get better at the game is just being like, oh, this shit. Oh, okay. Like, well, this is fucking stupid. And now I'm never going to lose this again. But there's, you know, hundreds and thousands of more moments like that and all the different maps and everything. And trying to just take this something that's so fucked up that maybe isn't even that good, but you just weren't prepared for it, and then having to
Well, that's the
plug
classic
in the
StarCraft commentary. It's like, well, this isn't even fucking good. This guy's doing a bad strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's it. That's the mental battle of StarCraft, right? Is constantly finding a way to take responsibility in situations where it really feels like you weren't responsible and it was some bullshit that cheated you out of the situation. So it's like, it's a punishing mental game, right? I think that's the real battle for StarCraft, even if you're in Platinum League. And I think that's why people who only play like 2 hours a week and have a very busy life otherwise, if they actually find a way to use StarCraft to conquer that, I think they get a shitload out of being a StarCraft player. I think it makes them like mentally tough.
Did you have a moment where you felt like you hit rock bottom as a pro gamer, where maybe financially you didn't win a tournament and now like, what the fuck am I going to do? Or was there a moment where you lost to a certain play style and you felt like this revealed that you couldn't learn something as a pro or you couldn't overcome something?
Oh, there's a few things popping to mind. So there was a player by the name of King Kong. I'm not sure if you ever heard of him. He was a StarTale kind of B-teamer in StarCraft 2. He played Brood War as well. Really cool guy, Sam. I haven't seen him in years, actually, but I would consider him a good friend. Really nice guy, despite him, you know, stealing all of my prize money. So he came to live in Australia. He was studying cooking and had basically said, I didn't make it as a pro gamer in StarCraft 2. Let's go learn cooking in Australia and, you know, go down other avenues. But as happens, you never truly retire from StarCraft, right? Everyone's like, oh, I retired. No. He's like, oh, I might as well play some tournaments for fun. Turns out if you've come from that rich history of Brood War and StarCraft 2, he was dominating Australia. And he would be really mega cheesy, and he would always beat me in Zerg versus Zerg. And I just could not consistently beat him. Maybe one in four series, I'd be like, yeah, I figured him out. And then he'd like have a new brand of crazy builds the next tournament and he'd get me and it would take me so many tournaments to figure it out. So every time that would happen, I'd be like, I know he's going to play these kind of aggressive styles, these gambles, but I just wasn't good enough to handle them under pressure over and over again. So that was like one big thing which always hit me and said, man, big part of my goal was to be a pro gamer, have to win every tournament in Australia. And this guy was like this huge obstacle I could not get past for many years. The other big one would be definitely, I think, 2014. I put so much pressure on being able to win at least a top 16 or like a couple of top eights or something at DreamHacks that year. And I was over there in Europe and I went to these tournaments. And like the first one, I didn't do that well, got knocked out by MC, like I said. And I kept getting knocked out by MC over and over again. So he became a nemesis of mine, right? And there was a really heartbreaking moment where I felt like I had gotten so good after a few months of practice. I was in the MYI house in Switzerland and I put everything into the game. And then I went to, I think it was like Gfinity I went to. And I played him there again. Literally every tournament that whole summer, and I smashed him in one game, and then I kind of got ahead in another game, and then I just like kind of fell apart completely and got wrecked. And then I played him again a few weeks later, and I'd hit a point where I'd trained too hard and I burnt myself out, and I just like could not perform. And I was like, I'd beaten him finally in an online cup like a week before that, and I'd figured him out and I'd handled it, and I started to beat these really good players, and I was sitting really high on the ladder, on the EU ladder at the time. I was like rank 2 or rank 3 or rank 4 a lot of the time, though it was a different system, so that might have just been more that I played a lot of games, but definitely top 10. And yeah, I remember I played this tournament and I was just so burnt out from practice. I couldn't compete. And like, I just couldn't perform. And it was like the last tournament where I needed that big performance. It was DreamHack Stockholm 2014. And I didn't, and I fell apart and I got crushed twice as hard as I had at any other tournament. Like, and it was like the worst out of all the tournaments where it had been like, I'd been getting better and better. And I'd finally started beating the best guys in online cups. And then I just fell apart and played like utter shit. And I had to go home and that was it. And I didn't have any way to get to more tournaments for at least like a year.
Oh, fuck.
And I got home and it was like the most crushing mentally moment, because I was like, oh, like I'm done. Like I can't get to more tournaments. I'm the best I've ever been right now, but I don't get any more chances. Like I had this real small window where maybe I'll get another chance in a few months' time, but it'll mostly be the Australian tournaments. And I started playing online cups and I was like winning them. This like month for months later, I was doing so much better. I was smashing a lot of really good players, and I didn't have anywhere to like put that, right? Because I couldn't get to these big tournaments, and even if I did, you know, I had trouble on stage and keeping my performance up at the big events when it mattered. So I remember that being this really crushing moment. And that was when I actually was really worried, because I'd been pro gaming and spending 100% of my time on just StarCraft. I had very little like social circle at the time because I was going too hard on StarCraft. Another thing I would change. And it got to the point where I basically started like streaming, because I was like, oh, I can't pay rent this month. Like I was literally like, I need to pay rent in a week and I have no money. And I was like, well, I can't get a job in that time. Cause I was literally thinking I'd just have to go get a part-time job, you know, at a store or something, whatever. And I started streaming and that picked up very quickly. And all of my friends who had been practicing with and talking to at these events kept raiding me, and everyone that was on raiding came out on Twitch.
Right.
So my stream instantly grew a lot, and there was a lot of people who were very generous with me, and that was me being like, oh, actually I could be a content creator. And then like luckily I kind of got into that, and then the next year was like the tail end of my pro gaming career while I was getting into that. But I remember there was like that week or two where I was like, oh, it's done. I missed the window. I didn't make it. You know, I can't keep competing. I can't pay rent this month. And it was like really, really sad moment. Yeah.
That's such a insane concept, because again, the tickets to get anywhere are so expensive, right? And so you get, yeah, you spend the money, you got to travel so far. And for those of you who don't travel, the jet lag is insane. It's killer. I mean, normally when we cast, they fly us in a couple days early just so we can try to acclimate to the new time change.
Yeah. My best performance was actually about 6 months after that.
Yeah.
You know what happens with pros where like when they retire, they're still the same skill level or even often better,
yeah,
because they're not as stressed.
And yeah.
For like the next 6 months to a year, happened with Marine Lord, was the one who I remember got to like the finals of a tournament 4 months after announcing his retirement and stuff. Like, you know, this sort of, yeah, thing happens all the time where players let off that stress a bit and your skill hangs around, and then there's a sharp dip off at a certain point of like, oh, well, you haven't been practicing seriously for like 8 months, like suddenly you become bad. But up to that point, you can hang around. So I remember having my best performance, and speaking of jet lag, they would fly us in, yeah, the night before to Cologne from Sydney, and I had to play my group, and it was played at like the equivalent of like, you know, 3 a.m. back home or something. And I remember like just chugging Red Bulls, and I'm like shaking at my computer. And I remember that was the moment where a lot of people would remember me like fist bumping overly excitedly was my most kind of viral moment as a StarCraft II pro there. And I remember I was like,
I know that.
I've seen that moment. So much Red Bull pumping through my veins.
I think there's a picture of you doing that somewhere in the Blizzard Arena.
There's two of the same picture. Yeah. I remember like cats or something took a photo of that. I was like, oh shit, that's there. That's cool. But so that was kind of the tail end of my career. And it's funny because I look at it all in the context of everything I've learned since then. And you're like, oh damn, it's like some dark times, but mostly it was just amazing to put so much into something. And I think if you can fail at that, as long as you've learned a shitload of stuff in that failing, like you're still going to improve as a person. So I think I was very lucky that, you know, I guess I'm natural for content creation and stuff anyway. But I think for a lot of people, it's something where that can be really hard. If you're a pro gamer and put everything into it and you don't have an easy transition, that's a very scary moment when you don't make it or you decide to move into something new.
But would you consider that you casting now and doing a lot of these events overseas and being able to use your knowledge to translate the game for people that are watching, do you feel like that, in a sense, is you making it but in a different way that's unexpected?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's the skill set, right?
Because that's the way I view what I have done.
Well, we've taken that experience and that skill set, right? Where you saw it as a competitor and someone who traveled out to these tournaments, and I mean, for you, it would have been driving, you know, interstate, right? To like,
oh, yeah,
you know, a different land.
No, you have to drive for like 14 hours to get to some place.
You sleep in the car or in a shitty hostel or something like that. You know, some
motel with drug addicts and hookers outside, and you're 19, and you know, just trying to.
You just want
to stay up all
game,
night with
man.
Your friends and try to explain your build so you go to the LAN center that's going to be closed down in 3 weeks because nobody goes to LAN centers in Texas and do your tournament and, you know, maybe win or maybe lose.
But it is that skill set, right, which we found a way to explain, I think, so much of what's on the line for the players. And I think, like, every now and then that's what I get really reminded of when a new commentator comes in and they're, like, really in touch with the players. And they're really good at communicating individual players' stories. That's the thing where I love getting reminded of that when I see, whether it's in StarCraft or another game, someone who does that really well. And I'm like, oh man, that's like beautiful. Because if you can make me connect to a player when I'm watching and just suddenly get on side with their story, whether it's a bit of adversity or just how hard they train, just something specific that makes them human. I think that's so important because so much of the time you're not watching an esports player, right? We're watching the screen. You don't get to see, whereas if you can watch a football player just do something that looks cool and you can immediately relate to that as a human who understands that looks friggin' awesome. It's not the same with games. So I think it's so much more important to kind of try to get that passion across somehow.
Dude, this has been a really good podcast, man.
Yeah, boy.
Dude, really good job, man.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, dude. Do you have anything else you want to talk about before I close it out?
Not really, man.
Not really?
I mean, this has just been a rambling conversation, which is what's
really
best
good.
For podcasting, man.
This has been really good, man. Thanks so much for doing this, dude.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Let's do another one down the road when we're together again.
Yeah, boy.
All right, man.
Thanks for having me on.
Dude, love you, buddy. Cheers. Thank you so much for listening to that episode. And thanks again to Pig for coming down to my hotel room and sitting there and taking the time to record that. I really appreciate it. Again, go check his stream out. He's also got a great YouTube page. I love that guy. That was really cool. It's good to be back in Seoul. I'm sitting here with my little fluffy cats. They're walking around me right now. Again, I will be doing another recording here, just kind of recapping BlizzCon and summing up the year. And we have a few more podcasts still recorded before we do the video stuff. I'm going to announce those guests coming up here soon, but I think you're going to enjoy those as well. Yeah, thanks so much for listening, guys. We're not stopping. We're going to keep building the show and keep making something cool that's a little bit different from everything else that's out there as far as content goes. If you can, support us on Patreon. It's patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. If not, no worries. Hope you guys have a great day. Be good to yourselves. I love you. Have a good one. Bye-bye. This episode was produced by State. Artwork by Ala Reese. Music by Mark Lentz. Special thanks also to our top Patreon supporters, Seth Rohit Sambadi, Charlie Sheaver, John Kernicki, and Tyler Toe Baggins Radsek. I love you guys. I'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.